You know, it's really true. Time flies when you're having fun. Howdy, I'm Jeff Goldsmith, and this is the Q&A. My agenda is simple. Each week, I plan to bring you in-depth insights into the creative process of storytelling. Folks, today you'll hear my 10th annual screenwriting nominees Q&A, and wow, I cannot believe that I've been podcasting this panel for a decade. It really does feel like time has flown, and this screening series itself is 13 years old, so that's kind of crazy too if you think about it. But as you'll hear, this year's Oscar-nominated writers of Best Original and Best Adapted Screenplay, they're an utterly fantastic group, and not only commenting on their own work, but also their creative process. They were a blast to interview, so I know you'll dig this episode. But first, I have a question for you. Are you crazy enough to write a screenplay? This episode is sponsored by the good folks over at screencraft.org. Screencraft is dedicated to helping screenwriters succeed by connecting talented writers with top producers, managers, and agents. You can check out screencraft.org for free screenwriting education and genre-specific screenplay competitions featuring thousands of dollars in prizes with judges from Warner Brothers, CAA, Sony Pictures, Lionsgate, 20th Century Fox, and more. The annual Screencraft Screenwriting Fellowship offers winners the opportunity to be mentored by Academy Award-winning screenwriters and producers. In fact, you can enter any screencraft.org writing competition for this entire year, 2017, and save 10% off your entry fee by using the special discount coupon code QAPODCAST, all one word, QAPODCAST. So hey, go check out the fine folks over at screencraft.org for more info, and don't forget to use your code. And speaking of cool things to do online, I hope you'll also check out my digital magazine Backstory on the iPad. It is the place to go for amazing television, film, and theater content. Remember, for you non-iPad folks, stay tuned to www.backstory.net for updates, because soon enough, it'll become the fully functional magazine. We're in the process of converting all of our back issues and figuring out the new software and how it works, so soon enough, you'll be able to see it all at backstory.net, and I thank you for your patience. So issue 26, our Oscar issue, is going to post quite soon, in fact, right before the Oscars, so I hope you keep an eye out for that. But if you have an iPad right now, issue 25 is our current issue. It's our Jackie issue, and it features an in-depth cover story with Noah Oppenheim about the writing of Jackie, with plenty of details not in our recent podcast. Also in issue 25, you could read a huge Nichols Fellowship piece where you could learn about the 2016 Fellowship recipients and what made their writing experience unique enough to catch the Academy's eye. You could also read a full Blacklist screenplay and interview with the writer, and a full Hit List screenplay and interview with the writer, or you could learn about TV's The OA or Star Wars Rebels, plus film pieces as well, so I hope you check it out. Right now, you could see our beautiful cover image and table of contents at backstory.net, and of course, you could buy or subscribe to it on your iPad, so thanks for considering. And remember, once again, while you're fiddling around online, if you have a script ready to enter into a competition, check out www.screencraft.org to see what they have coming up. But now, without any further ado, let's jump right into the Los Angeles Film School at my sold-out event as I introduce the very talented Oscar screenwriting nominees at my 10th annual Screenwriting Nominees Q&A. Welcome to the 10th annual Screenwriting Nominees Q&A. Great to see you all. It is very hard to do all of these things, so I have a couple thanks before we introduce our esteemed guests. Obviously, I'd like to give a thanks to our hosts, the Los Angeles Film School. And good old Cecilia Berry and Kelsey make it totally possible for us, and Joe, so give it up for all of them. And as we screen year-round, I'd like to give it up for our volunteers. So Jackson on sound, Susan and Jack, Danielle, Crystal, the whole crew. All right, so we're going to go alphabetically by film, and we're gonna get this panel going. So our first guest would be 20th Century Women. Let's give it up for Best Original nominee, Mike Mills. Good old Mike Mills, coming on down. Next up, Arrival, Eric Heiserer, Best Adapted.
Good to see you, man.
Next up, now this is a tough one, it's Hell or High Water. We have the ghost of Taylor Sheridan for the next 8 minutes while he's in traffic. So the ghost of Taylor Sheridan. Next up, we have Hidden Figures, good old Allison Schroeder and Theodore Melfi.
Okay.
I meant just Allison. Everybody move down a seat. Ted is not here. All right, so La La Land, good old Damien Chazelle for Best Original. Next we have Lion, Luke Davies, Best Adapted. And of course, there's Manchester by the Sea, good old Kenneth Lonergan for Best Original. And finally, Moonlight, Barry Jenkins and Terrell, Alvin McRaney, Best Adapted. So here's a few notes. It is statistically impossible, not improbable, but pretty much impossible to ever have the same group of writing nominees assembled on the stage again in the same year. So congrats on your nominations. One thing I'd like to point out, Damien and Kenneth Lonergan, it is your second Oscar nomination, but for everyone on this stage, including the ghost of Taylor Sheridan, it is their first Oscar nomination. So give it up for that. That's no easy feat. All right, so now that we've done all these accolades and we're in a good mood, I just want to bring things down as low as I possibly can. So what we're going to do is, I'm curious, and Mike has this look like he wants to answer the question first, so we're going to start on that end and move it down. What is your lowest point? Everybody during the award season, they've put you up on a pedestal as a writer, but it is not easy to sit alone in a room and battle it out with the keyboard. What was your lowest point either in your career as a writer or specifically working on 20th Century Women? Mike Mills, no pressure.
When I sat down here, I was like, oh, crap, I'm going to be the first one to answer these rows of questions. God, there's so many to choose from. There really are. It took me like 2.5, 3 years, and most of that was spent in like doubt and like, what the fuck am I doing? And so, can I cuss?
Fuck yes.
Okay, great. There's a few times when I had to just put it away because it was just making me so depressed and I was banging my head on the wall and it was just making it worse. And I had to put it down, which is a weird way, like the scariest, most vertiginous. And like when you're 1.5, 2 years in and you put it away, you're like, oh, fuck. Like I've failed so hard. That would be the lowest.
Eric?
Oh. And I guess the first to flash was actually sort of a career low for me, which was after I'd moved out here to LA and I had two different projects optioned. And I thought, this is it. This is great. It's not like just one lightning strike. I have a plan here. And like within 45 days, both of those had just dried up immediately and I was hemorrhaging money. And I had the one new idea that came to me when I was out here, and I called my manager and I said, I've got this idea for an original story. And my manager said, oh, they don't do originals anymore. And I'm also leaving the business. So I, you know, that was really, I'm like, fuck. And I said that over and over again until I think it was like Dennis Leary who talked about, finally you get out that last fuck, and then you get up and you start doing something.
Makes sense. Allison, your lowest point as a writer and what kept you going, I would add as well.
Okay, well, I'm on a pillow not because I'm a diva, but because my baby girl broke my tailbone in childbirth, so that was not a great moment. However, my lowest writing moment is, I remember I did 44 pitches in a row, and I couldn't book a single one. And my manager called me for our end of the year roundup, and he is just the biggest optimist. And I was like, oh, not a great year. Yeah, I don't know what to do anymore. You're a really great writer, and I love you, but I can't get you hired. And I was like, no! So that was my Christmas gift from my manager.
Very nice. Damien.
I guess I think my lowest point was actually, it started out as what seemed like a great thing. I was trying to get work as a writer for hire, living in LA, and I finally booked, you know, a gig that seemed very promising, and then and then I wrote it, and then the movie came out, and it's this masterpiece called The Last Exorcism Part 2, and And my favorite thing was to read a review that that said, I think, because normally reviews, I thought, well, at least what's great is I won't be like called out in the review, because normally they never talk about the writers in the review. And but somehow, I don't know, I guess this movie was the exception to that rule, because I read like some LA, it was in the LA Times, I'll always remember it. It said, you know, the movie is written by Damien Chazelle, clearly a and then they like listed my like I guess they found out that I'd gone to Harvard, so they really like liked that. So they said, Damien Chazelle, clearly
the ghost of Taylor Sheridan has shown up.
Oh.
So LA Times eviscerates you, Damien. Go on.
No, I'll just leave it at that.
No. Wait, and what did your manager say?
They said Damien Chazelle, clearly a waste of a Harvard education.
Oh, come on.
And I read that in print, and I was like, and I hadn't done anything really yet in terms of like stuff I'd wanted to do for myself. I was like, wow, I'm getting slammed for like for this. And but I also couldn't. What sucked was like they were kind of right, because the movie was bad, and it sort of, you know, motivated me. And I haven't written any horror sequels yet since then.
And the moral of the story is LA Times, not fake news, I guess.
Yeah, they tell it like it is.
Taylor, we're reminiscing of your lowest point as a writer, just to take everybody off the Oscar pedestal of being a nominee. What was something that was kind of one of your lowest points as a writer, and how did you recover from it?
Most of my low points were as an actor, of which there were many. As a writer, I recently had an experience where I had a film at Sundance that I wrote and directed, and
Wind River. It was excellent. Yeah. I saw it.
Oh, thank you. There are people who didn't share that view and expressed it with, you know, great prose.
Don't listen to him, man. I was there. I saw it.
And the thing that got me the most is that it opens with this girl running through the snow, and there's a poem that she wrote, teenage girl, and the poem is a voiceover over that. And this one critic began by attacking my poetry. And like you can wreck my screenplay, you can say whatever you want about my movie, but you're going to go after the poetry that I wrote trying to sound like a 15-year-old girl that's writing pretty good poetry. I want to find that guy. Really bad. I know his name. Jason. Yeah.
Based on your movies, I know you will find him one day.
It will end badly.
Luke, what was your lowest point as a writer, and how'd you get through it?
Well, in keeping with a couple of these stories about managers and agents letting you go or not being able to help you, so 2007, I arrive in LA, a relationship ends catastrophically, so I'm like, oh, okay, so I don't have to be back in Sydney anymore. I'll check out LA a little bit more, try and get meetings, try and get representation. Eventually, I get representation, and I do like two practice pitches, just basically sacrificial pitches where your new agent basically sends you somewhere and you don't know what you're doing. And then the writer's strike begins, the big writer's strike, 2007. And I'm like, and she's like, there are meetings around. And I'm like, can I just clarify something? If I take meetings now that the strike has begun, will that affect my ability to ever become a member of the Writers Guild? And she goes, yeah, that will... And I go, okay, so officially now I'm not taking any meetings until this is over. So then another 6 months pass, or however long that strike was. The strike ends, and 1 week later she calls me and she's like, I got really bad news, I'm leaving the business. And the other two guys in my section, they like you, but they're going to let you go. So that was the beginning of my low point. The next 5 years was I couldn't get representation. I still lived here. I didn't know what I was doing. I kept renewing visas and just trying to... I had nothing going on. I was just scrambling, couldn't pay my rent most months. It was tough. And then slowly, little things happen, one thing at a time.
And the good news is it's now really easy to renew a visa. So
you're good. You're good.
Kenneth Lonergan.
Well, I think it might have been... I was in my late 20s, and a friend of my...
my friend and I were pitching we'd gotten this big break to pitch an idea for a TV show to some big producer whose name now escapes me, and we worked on it really hard, and this was in the 90s, and it was still like it was in my apartment, and we worked on it hard. We had this outline, we went through it, we alternated, we had he was in one room and I was in another on an extension. I don't know if you guys know what that is, but that's when you're in a house with a telephone and it's attached to the wall.
Landline.
And you can both be on the same telephone. In the olden times. And it's not a great story, but we got through our comedy pitch and the guy said, okay, now fellas, I have the tough question for you. Where's the fun? And we were like, we apparently don't know. There's no fun. And that was the end of that story. So, I told you it wasn't a great story.
The good news is you all recovered. Barry?
Some years ago, I was hired, air quotes, I didn't get paid, but I was hired to adapt this thing. I was working on this thing. I was like really into this thing. I did two drafts of this thing for no money, but I was hired. And then there were a few typos in it. And I was off making a commercial, and the producer was like, hey, there's these typos, man. I would love to fix them. Don't want to bother you. Can you send me the file? And me, naively, I was like, yeah, sure, I'll send you the file, whatever. And radio silence, 1 month, 2 months, 3 months. I go, hey, what's going on? He's like, yeah, actually, I just took it. I'm just going to write it. And I was kicked off the project.
Wow.
But the next thing I did was go, hey, there's this play in Moonlight's Black Boys Look Blue. I think I want to start working on that. And that was when I went off and started working with Terrell on Moonlight.
Perfect recovery. Very good. Terrell, a low point for you as a writer.
Yes. Don't read the comments section ever. I gotta tell you the high so it will make the sense.
Of course.
The low. So I had just graduated from DePaul University as an actor. Ha ha. And I had booked before school was done, I had booked a job with Peter Brook. Do you guys know who Peter Brook is? Just asking. My students don't, so. So I booked a job in Peter Brook's company to do a show, and I had been accepted to the Yale School of Drama for playwriting, and I had deferred a year, which you can't really do, but they did, because I was going to do a show with Peter Brook. So I was deferred a year, and I had this job with Peter Brook, and my mother died, and I wrote In Moonlight, Black Boys Look Blue, and a friend of mine read it and was like, oh, great, we're going to, like, produce it. And then I said to them, as they were getting closer to, like, making it, I said, listen, I understand you guys really love this, but we can't shoot this in Chicago. It'd be dumb. And they were like, okay, cool. And so we went on radio silence for months. And then in a domino effect, I went to my mom's funeral. I came back. The Peter Brook show was canceled. The acceptance at Yale had been taken away because the head had changed. So the new head came in and I had to reapply all over again. And then the producer said, you don't want us to film it in Chicago? Well, you can take your script back. And gave me back in Moonlight.
That's terrible. But luckily Moonlight got made, so.
Yeah, and I reapplied to school and I went to school.
All right, good end.
It was low, though.
All right, we're going to elevate things. We're going to get away from the misery.
Yeah, how about that?
So here's where we are. These eight films that you all represent, there's something that I noticed that was kind of thematically interesting about them, in which your protagonists, they are having an identity crisis of sorts. They are trying to find their way in the world. And when the world doesn't accommodate to their way, they each reshape the world around them based on their needs. They become proactive. So going down that way, starting with Terrell and Barry, what do you think about the theme of an identity crisis for your protagonist? Because each of you with a similar crisis made it as an Oscar-nominated screenwriter. So there's kind of something this year that really clicked for each of you.
Because I don't have you around all the time. So when you're here, bro, hey.
And the only reason I do is because I know you were the hardest working man in show business. I swear to every time I see you, you're out there like pushing. You're out there with your plaque card and you're pushing this movie. So I love you for it.
He's looking for his way in the world.
His identity crisis. specifically with Chiron, I think his identity is in crisis, I think is a better way to frame it, or not a better way, the way I would frame it.
Of course.
In terms of talking about this film, I mean, he's being lobbed his identity from the beginning of the film. When we meet him, he's running through a building, and they're telling him who he is, or who they perceive him to be, and they're chasing him and persecuting him for that. And so I think one of the things that Barry did so marvelously in the shooting and in the rewriting of the script is creating a way that we could feel that those sort of labels being placed on us, the world sort of constraining us into these categories, and feel that character trying to burst out in these moments all the time. And I think that's what's really beautiful about it. It's you're watching a character literally go, I know this is what you call me, but here is how I'm going to rise up and try to find whatever it is that I essentially need and want. Does that make sense?
Absolutely. Barry, same to you.
Nah, he said it, bro.
Kenneth, you know, obviously he is retreated from the world based on his mourning, Lee we're talking about, and he is kind of reintegrated into the world and has a crisis, it would seem, of identity in finding his way again in the world, both as a caregiver, you know, a kind of parenting role, but also just as an individual, because it seems like he had lost his individuality. Talk about writing and directing the thematic of identity crisis.
Well, I guess I didn't really see it in those terms, but not that I reject them. I think it's an interesting way to look at it. But I don't. I think he's. It's actually kind of interesting, I guess, because he's just trying to function. He's doing this impossible thing, which is he doesn't want to live. He doesn't want to be involved with anybody, and he's trying to hold away these terrible feelings that he can't stand. So he's just trying to. He's made a little life for himself where he's just functioning, and then when something more involving happens, when his brother passes away and he's got to go take care of his nephew, at first just take care of the funeral arrangements and make sure the kid is well placed and everything is handled, not just practically but emotionally properly. That's a hard thing to try to do if you don't want to get emotionally involved. So that's already difficult. And then when he's given guardianship of the kid, he's got to deal with that situation also, if he can, from a distance as mere functioning and not being involved. But what happens, I think, and I've never thought of it in these terms, so it's kind of an interesting question, is that he then finds himself through trying to limit his actions to practical, functional activities, he finds that he is pulled into the real world by the emotional needs of this person whom he can't treat as a problem to be solved. And even though there's no moment where he yields, well, there are a couple, actually. There's a couple of moments where he notices that the kid is a human being whom he cannot refuse. And it's small adjustments, but just being involved with some other people, I guess, is what makes him come to life again.
Luke, your entire movie is the concept of identity. Talk about crafting the identity crisis for Saru.
Well, this 5-year-old boy who gets lost and sets in motion a catastrophe which lasts for the next 25 years in his emotional life, is caught between these. There's these gaps everywhere for him. It's the gap between his 5-year-old self and his 30-year-old self. It's the gap between his past and his present. It's the gap between, it's the geographical gap between India and Australia, and it's the psychogeographical, or it's the cultural gap between East and West. So there were these convenient vortexes into which all of his desires and yearning fall, and everything's kind of suppressed. We just figured if the first half of the movie succeeded in putting you in the mind of the 5-year-old kid in his panic and peril, then the second half of the movie, when it's suddenly Dev Patel 25 years later, it's 25 years in screen time, but it's 2 minutes in the audience's experience of the time. So we made that choice to run it chronologically, because we believe that in the mythic power of the story at its most basic level, you know, a fairy tale about reunification with the lost mother. And he ends up supposedly, theoretically, making his identity whole and complete by unsuppressing the things that he'd been pushing down for so long and going on the journey to find home.
And obviously there's echoes for Moonlight and for Lion, in which we see a young child, you know, become a man, and we really see it unfold before us. So it was just kind of interesting for both of those films this year that was in there.
Yeah, I found some beautiful poetic similarities.
Damien, in La La Land, Mia and Sebastian, they seem to define themselves by their work. And they are outsiders in Hollywood in the beginning of the movie. And you know, Sebastian's goals of having a jazz career, he's failing miserably at as well because he's too much of a purist. And they literally are shaping the world around them to conform to their needs by hook and by crook. And I'm curious about kind of writing that identity crisis and battling both of their fears and going forward to kind of get their careers, which is the identity that they're searching for the whole movie.
I mean, you sort of said it.
Whoops, sorry.
I think the one thing that I could add to that is in terms of the looking at the genre of the musical, you know, as a genre, that to me musicals are all about at their core, you know, this characters trying to will the world into something that it's not, you know. It's why musicals aren't utter realism. They're also not complete fantasy. They are rooted in the real world, but it's this sort of, it's a real world where occasionally we're allowed to kind of, the characters project their fantasies onto that world. However you want to kind of define what a musical number does, that to me it has something to do with that, which means it also has something to do with characters who are dissatisfied, you know. So I always find the best musicals, or the musicals I like the most, at least, are about, you know, people who are sad a lot of the times, but they break into these joyous numbers. That's the disconnect, you know. But that's what the whole thing is about. And so I think I just wanted to really try to kind of zero in on that tension, you know, the idea of people who have these dreams that the real world is not conforming to, and so they kind of act out those dreams, you know, not literally maybe, but metaphorically through musical numbers.
Just now we heard the other nominees talk about suppression and kind of, you know, owning it. Would you say that that was something that was an important character arc for both Mia and Sebastian, in which Sebastian, in his own mind, probably sells out a little to join the band and tour, but it helps him achieve his goal of the club, and Mia has kind of a disbelief in herself, and she has to kind of grapple with that?
Yeah, maybe. I mean, it's. I don't know. I mean, I think it's also that they have to learn to... I saw it a little bit as two characters who have to learn that reality is not always all that bad, you know, that you... that I think it's two characters who, much like myself when I first moved to LA, have this kind of combative relationship with the world around them. It's you know, it's the world that's, you know, keeping them from expressing themselves the way they want to, you know. Especially Ryan Gosling's character, Sebastian, has this sort of entirely combative relationship. And then, you know, I think bit by bit they learn, I don't know if they fully learn, you know, I don't know if it's fully a life lessons kind of movie, but they learn to a certain degree that this idea of compromise, this idea of trying to balance your dreams with reality, is not necessarily a horrible, soul-crushing thing, you know. And actually that you need some kind of compromise to just exist as a human and actually have a fulfilling life.
Allison. Obviously, Kathy, Mary, and Dorothy, they're immersed in a world completely foreign to them that they truly carve out based on their skill set to be an important part of. What were the challenges of identity crisis you found for Hidden Figures?
I mean, for them, I think it was that their identity as a black woman didn't fit with what people expected a scientist or an engineer to be. And so how did they have to convince people over and over and over again? And in real life, they were just persistent, and they showed up, and they had a lot of grace, and they had a lot of humor, and I was able to draw, I mean, I don't look like other writers. And when I worked at NASA, I didn't look like other scientists. And it's okay to be a woman and to wear lipstick and to wear heels and still love math and science and want to be a writer, and you can do all of those things. And so showing their story. Yeah.
Taylor, for Toby and Tanner, you know, obviously Toby is trying to create the family that he doesn't feel he grew up with, and they're trying to carve their way out in a world that is stacked against them regionally, in which the odds are not that they're going to succeed, so they take matters into their own hands. What did you find about the identity crisis of these brothers in their last attempt to do something, you know, great for their family?
Well, they're at an age, you know, they're in their very late 30s, early 40s, where you're pretty much doing what you're going to do. Reinvention at that age is an extremely difficult thing. I'd like to read that book. But they'd recognized that this was the best they were going to be, and they recognized their failures, and I think it was an acceptance of their identity, and then a certain, you know, selfish martyrdom, if that makes any sense, that they decided to sacrifice themselves for this next generation. And I thought there was a beauty in that, you know, in a real... It's a very fatalistic... It's actually not a... People laugh at the movie because there's funny lines, but it's really sad, you know, to watch these, you know, these two brothers, you know, decide, okay, we're going to fall on the sword in the hopes that the next generation doesn't have to.
Eric, in Arrival, obviously we have Louise and Ian, and they are the voices of reason in a chaotic world around them that cannot actually believe that aliens have landed to maybe help humanity rather than to destroy or fight humanity. So they are fighting within a storm around them the entire movie to find their place, as is Louise in her flashbacks, is fighting to have the daughter that she's always wanted, sorry, her flash forwards, to have the daughter that she's always wanted, even knowing the repercussions of that. What did you find about character and identity crisis specifically for Louise in that film?
Well, I think it's incredibly hard to imagine that authority figures would force scientists to defend their expertise.
Pure sci-fi.
Yeah, but I think in terms of like the biggest identity crisis is really just Louise struggling with a version of herself. Like, she's in the really spectacular position of knowing all the choices she's going to make and the chain that forms of consequences. And from that has to decide, is this who I am? I mean, is this who I will continue to be, knowing that some of these stories end in utter tragedy, like her daughter. What I like about that is that, like, we get into free will versus a deterministic kind of future, and it's possible that it is a deterministic future, and yet she embraces that simply because this is who she is, and she stands by her choices, knowing that even in the most tragic moments, possibly it steals her and it makes her strong for the next thing. And focuses on the gift of what other people around her get to contribute, you know, like the line that she says to Hannah of, like, you're unstoppable, like, with your poetry and your swimming and everything you give to the world. She's thinking about, here's how she affects somebody else.
Mike, Jamie and Dorothea are really companions in this, as they're both on their journeys in a world that seems foreign to them but is definitely changing around them, and they're trying to just grab on to some piece of it. And it seems like the whole movie is not only identity crisis for them, but for the surrounding ensemble as well, as everyone's trying to find their way. What did you learn about writing Identity Crisis?
It's an interesting way to phrase it. I'm not sure. Similarly, I put it that way in my head. I think unconsciously, probably because I'm doing this, my characters are all trying to figure out their like more authentic self. And there's a false self that you can perform. Maybe your family wants to do it. Maybe your society wants to do it. Or maybe in my film, Santis, I don't feel like my Jamie character is a protagonist in my movie, so let's just dump him aside. It's the three women. They are from very particular moments in history, and there's different sort of emotional models of self that are provided, and other ones that are really hard to acquire if you're from the 20s, 50s, whatever. So it was how to I think all my scripts end up being people trying to figure out how to be a more real version of yourself, and often it's about where you are in history, and I don't go in thinking I'm going to write that, and I'm always surprised, like, damn, I did it again, you know, at the end. So.
Lightning round, starting with you and just coming back. Short answer, doesn't have to be long, just a little peek at your process. I'm not saying that any of you do this, but if you do, please tell us. What is your favorite way to procrastinate? And how many drafts did you write of 20th Century Women before the film that we know? Mike, starting with you and coming down.
I love to write, like, you know, draft 5 when it's really like draft 300. Because I'd write so many drafts. All right, many iterations. What was the beginning of your question?
How do you procrastinate if you do? Your favorite way to procrastinate?
I just kind of enacted
it. To get your mind off the writing.
I'm going to give you a super honest answer. Ready? I think that I procrastinate by being depressed.
Okay.
I think I recede from the issue. I recede from my responsibilities as a human. I recede from the task at hand. And I go into a safe Oxycontin depressive thing that I've learned since a child. Right on.
Eric.
I'm a very iterative writer as well. I go through a lot of drafts just because I'm constantly just like, oh, what's down this way? Let's see what I do here. And sometimes my procrastination is just more writing for myself because that's how much self-loathing I have. Is that I just like, let's write the whole film from this character's perspective now because I hate myself.
Taylor.
Well, you know, the first two screenplays I wrote, I was borderline destitute, and I was crammed into a one-bedroom apartment off Sunset with my wife and a one-year-old with no AC in August, and there was no procrastinating at all. So I wrote really fast. My wife picked up on that and recognized that desperation with me breeds, you know, achievement. And I can remember I was writing this thing for Warner's, and I you know, she'd walk in, and I'm in my office, get out, and I'm at NFL.com, I'm checking stats, and I haven't written anything in like 3 freaking weeks. And she's like, and the next day she came home and tossed these keys on the counter. I'm like, what are that? She goes, that's my new car. How's that script coming? And about 3 weeks later, we were done. We were good. She's a motivator.
That's amazing.
Allison.
Well, I was hired to write Hidden Figures, so I was given 12 weeks. And I made my deadline because I'm a dork. And I'm terrified of missing deadlines. And then for the next one, I think I think there were like 3 more drafts. We spent a few months on them. And then I think Ted said he did a lot of drafts. And I only write at night. I started about 11 o'clock at night, and I write till 3 or 4 or 5 in the morning. And so I watch every single procedural on TBS. I've seen NCIS. I can quote it to you. I've seen The Mentalist. I've seen them all, and I love them.
All right, so you veg out watching TV.
Yeah, like I'm a 50-year-old white man watching NCIS and like think Mark Harmon is hot.
Damien. Ways that you procrastinate, and also how many drafts of La La Land?
Well, I mean, the procrastination is easy. It's definitely what I spend most of my time doing. It sounds somewhat similar in the sense of just watching stuff, but I try to.
Do you want to watch NCIS with me?
Yeah, we should set a time.
NCIS and chill.
I played the killer on that, by the way.
Sounds pretty great. But I also just like find ways of calling stuff like research or setting the mood for writing that never, like I'll spend a whole day figuring out a playlist for my writing. You know?
You should publish those. That'd be awesome.
Right. And, you know, it's, and then like I'll finish it because I have to do it before I start writing. But then of course I finish and I'm like, whew, I just did a lot of work. Okay. I better take a break. I'll start tomorrow. And it just becomes that over and over again. So it's like stuff that I would call research or mood setting that, you know, just procrastinates. But that's kind of the drill. In terms of number of drafts, I don't know. I mean, it was La La Land was the longest I've like worked on a single project, you know, in terms of writing it. So it was about, you know, about 5 or 6 years of writing. So you know, the first draft was pretty quick, and then I don't know, you know, I mean, certainly hundreds, but, you know, every few months returning to it and doing a new draft.
Just to follow up, only because you were talking about it, I've heard some other writers mention this. When you write to music and you have, quote unquote, that playlist that you were looking for, do you then keep it and write to the same music every day? Because some writers are very dogmatic about...
No, I mean, the playlist is really useless. I just do it as a... I do it because I tell myself I need to, and it's so much easier making a playlist than writing a script.
Absolutely.
So it always seems more appealing.
Luke, ways of procrastinating and how many drafts?
Compulsive masturbation. No, that is seriously not my answer. I just had this unstoppable Tourette's-like moment of thinking, that would be amazing to say that here. I promise that is not my actual answer.
Duly noted.
No, but it's just this thing. It's about 27 minutes into my working day. This thing happens, and it looks like this. It's like... And this thought comes in like, the fridge. That would be interesting. Just like... And then it's usually walking back from the kitchen to the desk. It's like, you know what? If I lie down on this couch and watch last night's episode of Game of Thrones, I'm kind of in the film and TV industry. I need to keep up with everything. And then my mind will be clear, you know? And so...
You could write off your cable on your taxes, too.
Exactly.
So you're set.
And then the other thing is, I do like a good trip to Whole Foods. And LA is amazing the way, basically, you do a trip to Whole Foods and you pick up that thing from there. And it's like, how did that happen? It's 3 p.m., it's 4 p.m., you know what? Start afresh tomorrow.
And how many drafts would you say for Lion?
Lion was two drafts in a 6-month period until the crazy bidding war, at which point this thing was suddenly real and financed, and then it was two more drafts in another 6-month period.
Kenneth?
Well, my whole life is a procrastination, more or less. I do everything possible to do nothing, as often and as intensely as I can manage. I mean, this just runs the gamut. I watch Star Trek episodes. I'm into the hundreds now. I can identify a Star Trek episode with the sound off, not watching it.
Nice.
Within a minute.
Would you ever want to direct a Star Trek movie? Are you that much of a fan?
Yes, but I'd have to do it my own way, or I wouldn't want to do it.
I hope you
really
would.
There's almost no point. I think it's done so many nice ways. But so that's that. I like to clean the keyboard. I get very clean. I get very clean when I'm trying to work. I have a Q-tip and rubbing alcohol and getting inside the little grimy areas inside the keyboard. It's really, that can keep you occupied for hours. It's a really great. If you get really obsessive about it, there's no end to it, because by the time you get to the end, it's gotten dirty again. Especially if you live in Manhattan, where the grime kind of settles in as you go. Let's see.
So not one of those compressed air things? That would be...
No. Just a Q-tip and a toothpick sometimes. If you wrap the toilet paper around the toothpick and dip that into the rubbing alcohol, it can reach into areas that the Q-tip cannot go.
This sounds like a cottage industry for
writers. There's also the needle-nose tweezers. Can also pull like the little, not to be gross, but the little hairs that sometimes occasionally fall out of your head when you're a 54-year-old man.
Just because we're going so in-depth, is this a detached keyboard or a laptop keyboard?
Any keyboard.
Any, okay.
It doesn't even have to be my keyboard. I'll be like, no. My daughter's keyboard is really dirty now. She's my child, and it should be clean. So I'll go work on that for a while. I mean, I could really go on forever.
All right. How many drafts of Manchester?
Well, the first draft didn't go so well. It took about 8 months, and then I had to start over. I think 2 years more to get to the second draft, and then I think actually three real drafts, and then just shortening and tightening and dealing with production problems. I don't know how many, because it was a little more of a continuous process. So I usually write one draft and then spend the equal amount of time getting that 20% better, and then the rest is kind of like just fine-tuning.
Barry?
I don't really procrastinate, I don't think. I mean, once I start writing, I just fucking write. Like, I wrote the first draft of this.
That's
thank
just
you.
Wonderful.
Only because This shit is painful. I just want to get it over with as quickly as possible when I'm doing it. So I wrote the first draft of this, the first draft that I did, in like 10 days, just because I was like, fuck it.
Wow.
But I also had to go to the other side of the world. I live in California. I went to Brussels, Belgium to write the script, to get far away from my life. Because at home, I have like hundreds of episodes of House Hunters International. And if I am home, I'm going to watch some random ass couple move to some random ass city in Europe. And then I go and look online to see what happened, and they broke up like 2 years later. Always happens. Always happens. But
or they get killed, and it's an NCIS episode.
Exactly. Yeah. But the internet is really just fucking death. And so like I have one MacBook Air where I've purposely like ruined the airport thing, and I'll take that to cafes to write with, and then I come back and I like hard slice off of that and put it into the Dropbox, which is ridiculous. But if I have the internet, I won't get any damn thing done. So if I can just get away from the internet, I can get things done.
So how many drafts?
This one was about 4. I mean, I guess.
Okay.
Yeah, about 4 drafts. Yeah.
Terrell.
In Moonlight, Black Boys Look Blue, I think I wrote 3 iterations over, 10 years? So, yeah, it's a lot. I wrote them to a playlist, though, and it was the same playlist. It was Nina Simone, and mostly wrote most of it to Centerman. I just would put that on. It's a 10-minute song, so I would just put it on and just write.
So on repeat?
I'm the same way. I get a song and I just put it on repeat.
Put it on repeat and listen to that one.
Because then it just goes, it becomes background. Yeah.
Barry, what was your song?
Oh, it was Thinking About You, but Chopped and Screwed. So channel purple, not channel orange. That was what Moonlight was fueled by.
And your favorite way to procrastinate? Procrastinate. Procrastinate.
I think I have 3 real good ones or ways that work for me best. One of them is I have arguments.
With yourself?
No, but like, so if me and Barry had a fight, which we'd never do, but if we did, I would go home and be like, I should have said this. And next time he says that, I'm going to say it like this. And then I go over it so much, then I realize that I'm actually writing, and I get tired of that. So then I'm like, fuck that. That's productive. So then I clean everything. I have to clean the entire house and make the bed. And then I I'll sit in front of my computer and I'll start writing and I fall asleep. So there's a lot of like F's. So sleeping's like my thing because I don't sleep very well when I do sleep. But for some reason, writing feels so meditative that I like pass right the fuck out.
I kind of would like to see the F version of your play. But so look, this is for this question. I want to get personal because I think it's important because each of your films are so personal. You know, Terrell, we're going to start with you and go back down the line. What is the most personal thing in your script that, unless you really told us today, we wouldn't really know? Something that is from an experience that you fictionalized or something from an experience that you kept as is? Something also uniquely that only you could have written because of your experience.
ask the kid whose life is on display.
and of course, it's very autobiographical.
Right,
so.
Right. So it makes it easier.
You don't have to answer.
This is true.
You can see this is what Kitty does. I love him.
You can take
I love him.
You can take
we'll go places. Kitty will be like, no.
You could pass it to Barry. You could pass it to Barry.
I want to tell you all about the most personal thing in my entire life that's in the middle of my script that I don't want to tell anybody about. But I turned into a fictional situation.
I don't know if it's the most, but I think one of the hardest thing to see in Moonlight over and over again, I will say, is the scene that Barry shot with Trevante and Naomi at the at the rehab center, and mostly because I remember going to the rehab center for my mom and being there and sitting there, and my mom was 6 feet tall, she was slender, she's a beautiful, she was a striking woman. We looked very much alike, and. So if I was a woman, I'd be very striking. And I just remember the nurses thinking, looking at me like, oh, is that your kid? Like kind of not, she was basically like, oh, your kid's a fag, essentially, like, and disappointed, because it was one of those religious centers, and so she was like, oh, that, she was disappointed in me for my mom, and I felt embarrassed. I just remember feeling embarrassed for my mom, embarrassed that I was her kid at that moment. But it's hard because I see when they do that scene and they sit there, there's so much love that they have between the two of them, and I wish that was the way that felt in real life.
It was a beautiful scene. Yeah, Barry.
And I'm
only going to rephrase. It could be any personal moment or just something personal that's not in the narrative.
You don't
have to go as far as Mr. Lonergan thinks I wanted you to go.
No.
Just because he's next. It could be any personal moment.
I'll go the opposite. So in the first chapter of the film, because the movie is more autobiographical for Terrell than it is for me, but there was all this space in the narrative for me to not insert myself, but to allow my experience into the film. There's this very, and it's funny, I'm speaking as the writer and the director. So in the film, there's this very simple scene where the two kids are wrestling, where Kevin comes over to Little, he's like, hey, don't let them pick on you. They start wrestling. That wasn't in the source material. But I remember thinking, you know, Little is this kid who's now just coming into this realm where he's even going to acknowledge that sexuality exists. And I remember what that felt like as a 10-year-old boy. And I remember being after school, and me and this kid were just standing around, and we started wrestling. And there was something that was happening that was not just wrestling. And if you read the screenplay, the way the scene is conveyed in the film as a director is very simple. It's very concrete images. But in the script, I think I was like, you know, I'm going to go to this place, and I'm going to experience what I think Little is experiencing, because I was at that place. And it was something I never talked to anybody about. I'd never written anything to that effect. But I think because the character was such a way, and Terrell is such a way, I was like, you know what, I'm going to open myself up and go back to this place and try to remember what that felt like. And I think in the script, it's very clear what that felt like. And so it was this thing that, to me, was extremely personal. And I like to say I got to hide behind Terrell McCraney, because until I say this in this room, everybody assumes, oh, well, Terrell McCraney was wrestling with boys when he was a kid. Yeah. It's like, well, no, he was not.
Like, please don't touch me.
Kenneth, anything you wanted to say, that something is personal, that it's unique, that only you could have written it? Nobody else on assignment or anything like that could have written it. A personal moment for you.
Well, I think those are two separate things, because I think that all these films and all these screenplays, and any good screenplay can only be written by the author of the screenplay, or it wouldn't turn out very well. But as for a personal moment, all kidding aside, and inspired by Terrell's wonderful answer, I think that this movie, I don't know, there was a period in my life when I was having professional conflicts that became financial conflicts, that became creative conflicts, that became personal conflicts, from about the time my daughter was 5 to when she was about 11, where I really felt like I just destroyed everything I had, and I destroyed my whole family. I didn't burn the house down, but I destroyed everything, and I ended up in debt. I was obsessed with this problem and trying to overcome it, and I felt like I just wrecked everything, and I would never get it back. And that's, I think, something that feeds the analogous and much worse situation in Manchester. And I don't even to this day know that I've fully recovered from it, and I hope I have, and I hope I can. But it wasn't a lot of fun.
Thanks for telling us about it. It's easy to see that in Lee's character, Luke.
I've been sitting here thinking, grasping for an answer and thinking, should I give a fake answer? But in the absence of giving a fake answer, because I can't think of anything in the Lion screenplay, I had the opposite experience. You know, I wrote this novel, Candy. It was a typical thinly veiled, semi-autobiographical first novel about my 20s as a heroin addict, which became a film, my first produced film. And when I wrote the screenplay with the director, we put real stuff from my real life back in, so that the novel was like, in actual fact, 70% my real life. I didn't say that in public situations with journalists. The film then became more like 85% again, because the director was like, that thing, that's really good. Let's put that back in. So I had that experience of watching a film that was completely not me, but felt very much a reconstituted aspect of my real life. That was kind of weird. But more specifically, last year I wrote this film called Life. Anton Corbijn made it. Ever since I've had email, I've had this email signature, which has this little quote down the bottom, which says, "He who knows he is a fool is not a great fool." And just a thing, quirky little thing, whatever. It's in my email signature. And so there's this scene where Dane DeHaan, playing James Dean, is in bed with, I forget the Italian actress's name, and she's lying there saying, "You're an idiot, blah, blah, blah." And he shrugs and says, "Well, he who knows he is a fool is not a great fool." And all my anyone who's ever had an email from me, they're like, "Dude, you put that line into the movie." So that was a thing I snuck in.
Damien, something personal about you that's in La La Land, something that well, is a moment that only you could have conceived.
Well, I mean, I don't know if only I could have conceived it, but I mean, I know the whole sort of the whole storyline, kind of in the latter half of La La Land, about Emma Stone's character putting on a sort of one-woman play and kind of the debacle that seems to be at first, was very much. I mean, that was very much. There were certain specific things there where, again, it's less directly autobiographical than like my previous film Whiplash, which was, you know, experiences I'd had. Here in this case, it was writing about kind of doing screenings of my very first movie, and just the certain kind. I wanted to try to capture a little bit of like that feeling of sort of putting yourself out there and there's like no one to answer you back, you know. And it was very important to me to have both sides of the coin, to have, you know, an empty theater where you sort of do your whole thing, because I remember that. I remember doing, you know, Q&As in a big theater and there's like two people in the audience, you know, and you're like, "Any questions?" You really hope one of them raises their hand, you know. But then even more importantly, the feeling of, you know, going, say, to the bathroom, or in the case of the movie, she goes to her dressing room and overhearing the chatter in the hallway or the chatter outside of people, trashing whatever it is you did. And you know, whether or not they're correct or not, there's just something, like there was something about that kind of pain that was really important for me to, because I know that was a scene that sometimes in the script seemed like it could have been lopped out. And I remember just kept like demanding that, I don't know, like I think people argued to me that, well, we get that the show is like a failure, you don't need to also hear these voices in the hallway and everything. And rightly or wrongly, I think because it was so personal for me, that was one scene that I just knew I couldn't, I cut a lot of stuff, but that was one scene that I had to keep, because I think it's not enough to just kind of have not a bunch of people, you know, to have an empty theater. I think there's this other thing that maybe all of, at least I've been through, and maybe all of us here have been through, of the actual, like, hearing what you're not supposed to be hearing and what that does to your head.
Right, the vulnerability of the artistic criticism. But it works, obviously, because we have to see what she's retreating from so that she could come back to it and be brave later. Mm-hmm. Allison, what's a personal moment for you in Hidden Figures?
Well, a little trivia is the Harrison secretary is named after my grandmother Ruth, who was a programmer at NASA. So that was a shout out to her. I think the biggest, I wonder if someone else had started this, if there would have just been one, it would have just been Catherine, right? Because the idea is, well, there just will be one protagonist and we can only have one black woman on screen. And from the get-go, I was like, nope, there's three. And not only are there going to be three, but they're going to not tear each other down. And they're going to lift each other up, and they're going to be friends, and they're going to laugh, and they're going to cry together. And I think, as a woman, there are so many moments, so many freaking indignities that people don't even realize that we have. And I think there's a lot of little moments in that film where you get to see it with these women, and it matters. You know, it's not that Al Harrison's a bad guy. He's just, he doesn't think about how a woman has to pee, you know? And when I read that Mary Jackson, that the women laughed at her in that hallway when they realized her bathroom was so far away, I just felt such rage for her. And then when I thought, she has to run in heels and nylons in the summers of Virginia and the winters, that's fucked up. But as a woman, we do it. We do it all the time. And I never in a million years thought a running to the bathroom storyline would make it into a Hollywood movie. And it did. and she's amazing in it.
It was beautiful.
Taylor. Thanks.
There's two. So the scene with Toby when he goes to his son to tell his son, you know, don't be like us, do it different. You know, that was my biggest fear at that time, because I was broke and I was terrified about failing this child. And so I imagined that fear like self-loathing writers do. I took it to the extreme and imagined it beyond that point. So for me, that was the most personal moment, the most like autobiographically accurate moment was when the character of Tanner, you know, is about to get in a fight with this guy, and he's like, boy, you'll think there were 10 of me. And the first time I heard that, I was outside a bar in Fort Worth, Texas, and this guy ran up, and he's pretty drunk, and he threw his keys at my friend as though he was the valet and hit him in the chest. We're outside this bar, and he goes, go get my truck. And my buddy goes, boy, you'll think there were 10 of me. And we got, so we he didn't, when you say that, no one fights you. And so we got in the car and we're leaving. I said, that's the funniest thing I've ever heard. He goes, yeah, wasn't funny first time I heard it.
Eric.
Oh, I when it gets down to it, a lot of my motivation for writing is really just to further court my wife. She's never given any indication of this, but I always feel like I'm in a Scheherazade situation where she'll wake up and she's like, why am I with you? You know? And so I'm constantly trying to. And I think one of the reasons why I gravitated toward this film so much is that there's a lot of characteristics in Louise that I found in her, in Christine. And I thought, okay, I know this. I know this woman. I think I can write her. But I don't, like, when you're close like that, she's among many things, she's a TV writer as well. And I get far angrier at stuff that goes on, like little injustices in her life, than she does. She's like, no, this is what it is, just being, you know, a woman in that. But when she came back, she's like, she had a pitch for something where a minor character who was a woman was like the head of a construction company, and the showrunner was like, but who's really running it? And I was like, son of a, no, like I almost blew my top. And then I would have to go off and write Louise, and that just started to seep into it, especially when, because I grew up in Oklahoma, and there were people in my community, adults, who would use air quotes when they said the word science. And here I am suddenly with someone in a room arguing with a scientist and just trying to tear down her expertise and her ideas. And I literally typed in all caps, why do I have to keep talking to this man? And that wound up being like my favorite Amy Adams line that just sort of came out of like my frustration of like, shoot her! You know, that was it.
Mike, a personal moment for you that ended up in the script that you're really proud of, that you want to illuminate?
I mean, my script is so many. That's both the way of writing that makes me most nervous and most comfortable, is to deal with things that really happen to me or really have seen. I feel like they have the most electricity and value. So every page in my script has something raw that I probably shouldn't be sharing. Thank you. The one that always surprises me, towards the end of the movie, the boy says, you know, I thought that was the beginning of a new relationship with her, but maybe that was as close as it ever was. Every time I see him, I'm like, oh, I said that? You know, because that's how it is. There's so many. That's how I write, basically, stuff like that.
Makes sense. Fair enough.
Ooh, hey, I'm cutting in really quick to remind you all about my digital magazine, Backstory. It's an iPad magazine that focuses on the art and business of storytelling. Currently, we're an iPad-only magazine, but fear not, we're coming to the web very soon, and you could check out www.backstory.net for updates. All of our issues have actually been converted by now. We're just trying to make the technology active and working so you could read it on the web. So I can't wait for you to see our web rendition soon. It's important to note, especially in this podcast, that our Oscar issue is just about ready to publish. It'll be issue 26, so I hope you check that out when it does. But right now, if you have an iPad, you could check out issue 25, our Jackie issue, featuring an in-depth cover story with Jackie scribe Noah Oppenheim. Plus, we interviewed all of the 2016 Nickel Fellows about how they landed their prestigious award from the Academy. You could read Justin Shady's Blacklist script, Saving Charlie Chaplin, in its entirety, along with an interview with Justin. Or you could read Calvin Starn's hit list script, Glass, in its entirety, along with an interview with Calvin. We've got TV pieces from the creators of the OA to Star Wars Rebels, plus current cinema pieces that include 20th Century Women, Gold, Hidden Figures, and a great spoiler piece on Rogue One, A Star Wars Story, and more. So folks, don't miss this issue, and I can't wait to hear your feedback about it. Remember, if you have an iPad, the app and issue one are both still free, and each individual issue costs less than a beer at a hipster bar. So treat yourself. And of course, while you're fiddling around online, don't forget to check out screencraft.org. There's plenty of articles to read there, and there's plenty of competitions to enter. And you could use your special coupon code QAPODCAST, all one word, to save 10% on any screencraft.org screenplay competition entry. Look, I really appreciate all your help in spreading the word about and supporting my passion project, but now let's jump right back onto the stage at the LA Film School as the Oscar screenwriting nominees continue chatting about their passion projects.
Another quick question, Terrell, starting you going all the way down. You're all creative types, and
Yes.
You're all creative types, and I'm just curious, something that you use as a tool for inspiration, and a favorite script or book that you've read that kind of really spoke to you as a writer. So is there a book you like to go back to, a film you like to watch, or a script that really inspired you, especially while working on this project, that you want to call out for other writers in the crowd to hear about?
Yes, but you said quick. Okay, so
you got time.
I'm trying. 45 seconds. We learned that today. Book that sort of pushed me to the brink, still pushes me to like the brink, is this book called Visitation of Spirit. It's by Randall Keenan. And it is incredible. It's like this unsung thing that is just incredible. The end. And I also love, I'm a huge dance fan. So especially in my writing that isn't filmic or for television, especially for a lot of theater, I go see dance. And I like will sit and I'll like go back and look through Martha Graham pieces or watch Rite of Spring by Pina Bausch. And just watch those dancers flail their bodies on stage, and I'm like, yeah, okay, I know this. This is what I, you know, it gets me going.
Barry?
It's weird, because as a writer and director, it's often working in concert, but I usually, because I don't sleep well either, which is why I think the character in the film doesn't sleep well, I get up early, usually. Even the way my apartment's set up, there's no real blinds on the windows, because I just know once the sun's up, I'm going to be up. So I watch movies in the morning, very, very early in the morning. I have a really extensive Blu-ray collection. And when I first moved to L.A., my buddy was an assistant at this agency that doesn't exist anymore, and Billy Ray was one of his boss's clients. And so I just have this treasure trove of Billy Ray screenplays, like actual physical scripts that he's written from circa, like, basically 2000 to 2006. And I think he was just in a fucking moment, because there are amazing screenplays that will never be made. And so every now and then when I'm stuck, I'll just pick up a Billy Ray and thumb through it.
Is there a title of a fave, just so people can keep on the lookout?
I get in trouble, man. I can't.
All right,
I'm sorry.
Kenneth?
Yeah, I guess I go to anything that's emotional or stirring or inspiring. I mean, I guess you're asking what's inspiring. So I think for this particular film, stories about people taking care of each other, I found to be like anything that'll kind of get me upset or interested or feeling like this film called Bang the Drum Slowly that I just love. It's a coal miner's daughter. I also love that film. Obviously, weirdly enough, Stanley Kubrick films for this movie in a way, because the kind of cold relationship he has between the characters and the environment and their circumstances. And music, I'll listen to music a lot. I like classical music, so I'll listen to like really emotional music. Helps me get in the mood and feel good about it. And sometimes if I'm really like in a low point, I'll just look for any kind of inspiration, like Fred Astaire and Ginger Rogers. Watching them just makes you realize how great people can be at what they do. And I always think that's what I would put in a space capsule, just to show that, you know, Earth, the planet Earth, was somewhat worthwhile.
Was there a particular Kubrick that you favored, like Barry Lyndon?
Yeah, Barry Lyndon's my favorite one, and then 2001 Barry Lyndon. Those I just love them. They're just so beautiful, and they're so powerful.
Thanks, Luke.
I'm a poet. I regularly just return to reading. I read a lot of poetry. It's like a psychic palate cleanser, in a sense, because it will put you in touch with the the primal linguistic energies of existence, I think. I can't listen to music all that much when I work, but there's one guy I can listen to again and again. He's an electronic composer called William Baczynski, and he wrote this five-hour piece of music called The Disintegration Loops. He recorded this stuff in the late 80s on tape and then forgot about it for 20-plus years. No, in the early 80s. When 9/11 happened, he decided to move out of New York, and he was clearing out stuff, and he found these old tapes in a shoebox. He started playing them for the first time in 21 years, and as soon as he started playing them, the acetate started disintegrating, and the sound started just mulching up. And then so he quickly recorded that stuff as that music was decaying, and he turned it into this magnificent, trippy, five-hour piece of music, which completely clears my mind into a sort of blankness that makes the creative process really lovely.
Damien?
In terms of... I do actually, like Barry, I if I'm trying to write, I do find it really helpful to read actual written, actual screenplays wherever I can get them. And paying attention to things that, not just the dialogue, but to how just the prose style of the writer, or just, down to how they format, or all these little tricks that I just love how each writer has such a different... So I love reading Billy Ray scripts. I like reading William Goldman scripts and Tony Gilroy scripts. Gilroy's really good at like making you turn the page. So there's just kind of stuff like that that sometimes it's just mechanical, but kind of at least makes me juices me up to actually do the otherwise to me completely painful job of typing, and actually writing stuff down.
Allison,
I'm also a big dance person, musical theater. I watch a lot of Friends reruns. I tend to gravitate toward things with a happy ending. So John Hughes, trashy romance novels, these are all my inspiration. For this, it was just the women themselves. And I think this was wish fulfillment, because I want to write movies the way I wish the world was sometimes, as opposed to the way it actually is. So I keep thinking, maybe if I write it, people will be more like that.
Taylor.
Yeah, I've tried all of that. I've a lot of times I'll try and write some kind of, poetic version of what I think the root of the story is, though I've been told by Jason I'm not very good at it.
We're going to find him.
That fucker.
Jason's going to wish that it was Kennedy.
But, it usually involves like abstract things for me. Music is a big influencer on me and inspiration, and a lot of times it's classical music. To find the tone of something prior to choosing music that's more correct for it. I listened to obviously when I was writing Hell or High Water, a lot of Waylon Jennings and Willie Nelson and Jerry Jeff Walker and this music that was kind of iconic of Texas, in the 70s. But I listened to Rachmaninoff's Vespers over and over and over to find the tone for me, because that was sort of a requiem, and the film was sort of a requiem. So for me, it's not reading things so much as trying to paint this, clear the palette in my mind, tonally, so that I understand the tone of what I'm trying to say.
Eric.
Michael Clayton. That's my church. But I gotta be right about it. There's some meal planning involved in my inspirational writing. Like, I can't start off with a Walter Hill. I gotta wait until I think, yeah, that's plenty of words. That's good. That's just the right amount. And then I can go look at Walter Hill. And he's like Gary Sinise in Apollo 13. He's like, all right, I got four words. I can write all of this in just four words, Eric. And he just makes it work. He's like haiku. But if I start there, I'll never write. I just get too depressed. It's like, the first time you heard Rush and you were trying to be a high school drummer, you're like, well, I'll just stop, because obviously all the drumming is ever, it's done. When I wrote Arrival, I listened to a variety of music, but I did eventually have the advantage of Denis works the way that I love That's how I worked when I shot my first film. And I love directors working where they bring the composer on very early. And so Johansson was actually scoring stuff just to this script and sending off samples. And if I had to do any rewrite, you know, during that time, I would totally listen to it. But before Johansson, I was listening to somebody, and nobody's ever heard of Eddie Jobson, Theme of Secrets. That's like really like, whew. No one knows that. See, silence.
They'll look it up now. Mike.
A big part of my suspension of disbelief is caffeine, and it's like really crucial. Noise-canceling headphones with songs looping, like one song all day or a week. Rihanna's Stay is a big part of this movie for me. I can't listen to that song without crying. Also, Joanna Newsom's record Yves is a big part of this. Fellini interviews are hugely encouraging and expansive and delicious and like just like can make you run into a forest at night, you know, happily. I say that as a positive thing.
Like finding a Fellini interview on YouTube or like
no,
audio?
No, there's a great book of all the directors talking with the purple band at the top. It now costs
Fellini
like $300 on whatever. Yeah, Fellini on Fellini. He's amazing, most encouraging director. And Fellini was big for this movie, so I'd watch 8.5 a lot and kind of intoxicate myself and scare the shit out of myself with like that movie. And then what you said about Ginger Rogers and Fred Astaire was really beautiful to me. And like I watch Casablanca like maybe once a month. For the same thing, I just feel like it's a perfect rock of human capability.
Mike, starting with you and coming back down, what was your biggest lesson on this film? Something that either informed your creative process and will continue to inform you as you go forward, or something that you learned that was unexpected, that until you were deep into it, you couldn't have been ready to handle that situation?
There's two answers. One is that it's impossible to answer a question like that.
Good.
It's like too processy and thick, and you don't know what you're doing. When you're really doing, when you're onto something, you don't know what you're doing, right? So you don't know how to explain it to other people. That's one weird negative impact of doing press about your movie. It's like the
sure.
counter of that. It's like, hey, Barry. And the
There's
other thing I learned, which I really loved learning, and I knew, but I just know more, is that I love directing. And I feel like I did it in a past life or something, and I feel like incredibly privileged to get to do it, and like incredibly lucky. And when I'm on set, I'm just like kissing the ground constantly in my head. And I was old enough to like just own that, cherish it, be down with it, not doubt it. That was great.
Eric, your biggest lesson on Arrival?
That I'm with Mike. That's kind of an impossible question to answer. I can say, though, that you know, there are a lot of voices, there are a lot of demons that show up and tell you when you're trying to write that you can't and that it's not going to work for a variety of reasons. And they can roll out. And sometimes they're as much of a paper tiger as they are in reality, it's really hard to not listen to them. And now I have a weapon to use against that, which is the voice that said, no one's ever going to come see a story about whatever it is that you're actually interested in. You cannot write a movie and have that get made where someone uses the term nonlinear orthography. Well, actually now I can. I mean, I feel like that's the thing that I loved so very much about all these films here is that they're so unique, and I could see them conquering the voice in someone's head that said the same thing.
And I will amend my question as we move forward to Taylor. I do agree that there is an unconscious level of writing and creativity that cannot be properly articulated. So if you want to focus on something that surprised you, no matter how much planning you could have done beforehand and how you creatively battled that surprise once you were in the thick of it, that's fine too. Basically, your biggest lesson.
Yeah, that's a terrible, unanswerable question.
I tried to amend it.
Still not answerable.
Your biggest lesson. Somebody asks you 30 years from now, what'd you learn from Hell or High Water? What would you say? I know you don't have the distance yet.
I think what I would say is if you look at all of these films, they're all deeply personal films that defy convention. By the rules of Hollywood, one could argue none of our films should have been made. Not one of them. And yet... and yet, we all decided to tell a story that mattered to us in the way that that we wanted to see that film ourselves. And if you look at the structure of all these films, if you look at the way that they're constructed and the way that the story is unfolded, they're all really unusually constructed films and really daring in the, you know, as opposed to revealing the plot point on page 17 and here we're on page 69 and we're at the third act. No, it's an entirely, all of these films really. And so I think what the lesson is, you know, we're not that unique. What is interesting to me is probably going to be interesting to other people, and breaking all these rules is exactly the thing to do and to further advance the craft of storytelling through a camera, more so than visual effects or anything else. It's the construction of the story and you know, being daring when you tell it, and I think we all were. It's a real honor to sit on this panel, I'll tell you the truth. It really is.
Absolutely. Allison.
Ooh, in terms of the writing, I learned always go to the truth, always do your research, because it's often far more interesting than anything you could ever make up. I never thought about 5-year-olds, 7-year-olds, 10-year-olds going to this. I never thought about field trips to this movie. And it made me realize, why not? You know, when I was writing it, they were always ladylike. And ladylike is a PG rating. It doesn't mean it's not adult. It just means, you know, you don't need a big sex scene or the big gun scene or a lot of cursing to make a really enjoyable movie.
You can have them, though.
But you can. Yeah. I mean, yeah, definitely. But you know I liked your movie. But and the thing I've learned professionally is I'm going to start saying no more often. I walked into a meeting last week. He didn't know who I was. He didn't know what movie I'd written. And when I told him what movie I'd written, he'd go, "Ugh, who thought that would be a success?" And from now on, I am walking out of the room when this happens.
Nice.
I really won't, but I dream I will. I pretend. I won't, but I pretend.
I think you've earned the right to walk out.
No, I need the job. No, I really need the job.
Damien.
I guess, you know, I mean, I think it's, I don't know, it's sort of broad, but I mean, I think, I guess the thing I'm still trying to learn is find that balance between, you know, holding true to your own convictions and being open to other ideas, you know. Trying to, I guess it's a little bit the transition from the writing phase to the filmmaking phase for me is kind of going from solitude to an essentially collaborative medium, and I think I learned a lot on this movie, especially of just kind of letting go a little bit of my initial instinct that anything that like was like an idea or a note that seemed to be kind of create upheaval in whatever I'd constructed, that any of that had to be resisted, you know. I think I learned a lot from just listening and from you know, it's reminding me more and more that at least on the filmmaking side of it, once you've done the script, the most important part of the process is choosing who you're going to work with to make that script a reality. And if you pick people who are smart, will make you better, then it behooves you to listen to them.
That's a great lesson. Luke?
It was about, the lesson was about standing by your strongest convictions. And for me, it was clear from the beginning that film financing logic would say that you should not begin a film with a 5-year-old non-professional actor speaking in Hindi with English subtitles for the first 50 minutes if you want to reach a wide audience. But I just, deep in my heart, it was like, this story is so simple and pure that we can actually begin that way, and we need to begin that way because it gets psychologically complex and diffused if we don't begin that way. So I really strongly argued that point right at the beginning of the process, and fortunately, Garth, the director, was like, cool, I agree with what you're saying. The producers were like, okay, if this first draft, good. If it doesn't work, we'll change direction in the second draft. Okay, everybody agreed? And we were like, yeah, of course, we'll see. But when we did, we found that this was the structure that the story should take.
Kenneth?
I don't know. I guess for the writing, I think that you have the right to write about anything that you care about, and that you have, and that you can and I think what's a little bit of a surprise to me, because I wasn't sure I had the right to write about this subject because I hadn't gone through it myself, and other people have, and it's much worse than anything I've gone through, but I've also been supported and taken care of and helped and guided through difficult things, and I think that I, at some point, I really wrestled with that, and I thought maybe I have no right to make this movie, and then I thought, well, you know what, why shouldn't a movie be about something serious if I care about it and I have some respect for it? And then I think, and then once the film was made and people liked it, that you can expect that if you care about it, other people will too, which is a really, not just a personal, not just a personal reinforcement or an ego boost, it's a kind of a beautiful connection that you make with strangers, and it's really encouraging to anybody who has a movie they want to write or direct that they don't think anyone else will like. If you like it, you can be sure somebody else will like it.
Great advice, Barry.
Yeah, just real quick, I want to go back to the previous question because I thought of something. There's so many young faces in the room. The Sunday New York Times obit section, you guys should read. There are people passing away right now who lived through some amazing, amazing times on this planet. And when you read their stories, they say truth is stranger than fiction. It's amazing. It does two things. One, it can show you how many choices you can make in your life. But also, too, when you see, when you go 80 years back in time weaving the path of somebody's life, it just shows you how these story structures were told we have to conform to. When people live their actual lives, they very rarely conform to those conventions. So I wanted to toss that out to the previous question. For this, the story is I went to Brussels, Belgium to write Moonlight. I actually went to Brussels to write another thing. I adapted a novel that I thought was going to be my next film. I took Moonlight just as this thing to get me back writing. But this amazing thing happened. There was no pressure. I was like, oh, I'll write on this for a couple of days, and then I'll toss it aside once I get back to writing. And because I didn't feel this extreme pressure, the writing was actually enjoyable. And I looked up, and 10 days later, it was done. And so what I'm trying to teach myself now is to always approach the process that way. I should have to trick myself into believing that there's no pressure, that I have the right to fail. And so that's what I'm going to carry forth into the next process.
Terrell.
I think, because I was like, Barry's talking. Listen to what Barry says. that's totally where I was. So I was like, I'm so sorry. I'm a Libra. This is information you don't need to know. But I.
Mike's clapping.
I think of it as I'm not very confrontational. I'm not very I'm Venus. I'm love. I'm cordial. That's what I think I do. But what I learned by giving this script to Barry and sort of really making myself stay the fuck away and like let them make the film. I did that most of the time, right?
Entirely.
Okay, cool. I was like, did I show up one day in my sleep? No. But one of the things that happened after I saw it and after he showed it to me is I became so proud and defensive in a way that I don't know what happened. Something clicked in me that was like, defend this, or make sure that people know you have a right to tell this and be this. I don't know where that came from or if I've ever had it before. Usually, I know with my work, usually I go, yeah, I can see how that's not that good. Yeah. Or, you know, cool, yeah, I can hear you. But for this, I was like, no, stand the fuck out there for those people who came, who stood up for you and stood up for your life and make sure that they know that there is a space for this, even in the pantheon of films that don't recognize the same structure or even content. You have to stand up for it. And I don't know what to do with that, except that I now feel that way about my students' work, right? Now my students will give me something, and they'll kind of go, well, it's not that. And I'm like, I'm standing up for it. You put it out there. Your voice is more important. So thanks, I guess. I don't know if I felt that way ever before.
I've asked this question 10 times. I only ask this question once a year. You have a choice. You could answer it seriously. You could answer it humorously, or you could take the fifth and move on. Here's the question, because I've had some really good answers over the years. Damien's heard this one before. And we'll start with Terrell. I thought you were off the hook. If you were hired as a rewriter to rewrite any of these other Oscar-nominated scripts, what would be something that you would change? It could be something as a fan. It could be a comical reworking of it. It could be something, a scene that you love these characters so much you wanted to see. What would be something that you would do in a rewrite if you were hired to rewrite any one of these other scripts? No pressure on Terrell.
I would change the song choice that Barry picked in Moonlight for the car.
Really? Yeah. Interesting.
All right.
You want a classic?
No, not classic, man. I'm talking about On the Ride Down.
Oh, you don't like the
No, I love it. I love it. But I wanted to add another song by Luis Pedro. But I was like, that's it. That's
all right, good.
I was like,
Barry, if you were hired as a rewriter for any of these other films, you could take the fifth, you could invent something that you wished was in one of these films.
I know the answer to this question. La La Land, and I would switch it. I would have Emma be the jazz person, and I would have Ryan be the actor.
Interesting.
Yeah, yeah.
Very
It'd
cool.
It'd be dope.
Love it.
I mean, it's dope, but...
This is what I love.
I just want to hear her explain to him what the fuck jazz is about. I'm serious.
So essentially, no mansplaining is the note. No mansplaining.
I mean, no. Explaining is gender neutral.
True.
I would just switch the actors.
I like your spirit, Kenneth.
This may sound a little strange. Just as a pure experiment in abstract expressionism, I would, without changing anything else, I would recast the three black women in Hidden Figures as white men.
but the same script,
and
the same
see,
script.
And just see what the movie was like.
I hope someone stages that as a play one day. Excellent answer. Luke.
So, with all due respect, I love La La Land. I would have loved to have seen a fragment of the catastrophe of the one woman show that she performed.
Oh, so see the scene. See the humiliation.
Or I would have proposed to write that scene or whatever. I don't know if it ever existed. I have no idea of the actual
Damien,
circumstances.
Damien, did it exist? Was there a version where you were going to show the scene from her show?
Yeah.
And was it cut for time?
No, it just didn't seem to...
All right.
Yeah.
Damien, if you were hired... if you were hired as a rewriter on any of these other films, what's something that you would love to add, change... Or you could take the fifth.
Oh, yeah, I'll take the fifth.
That's what you did.
See, Damien went to Harvard. He's smart.
Damien is consistent. He is consistent because that's exactly what you did when we were talking about Whiplash on this panel a few years ago. Allison.
I'm going to get in trouble for this, but Kenneth, he's sleeping with two high school girls. That's not cool. Couldn't you just, like, a little come
does
up?
Does that not happen?
Not when I'm Dana Boy, it's just me.
All right.
But no, seriously, does it not happen?
I'm sure it does. I just wanted him to get his due at some point.
What do you mean? He's with a girlfriend who's not so great, and then he goes with a much more interesting person who gives him a hard time and knocks him around. Don't you like that?
Yeah.
Sold. Taylor.
Sold.
I'm gonna fall on a word that you invented about half an hour ago. Which was, you didn't think I was going to let you get away with that, did you? When you said procrasturbate?
Yes.
which I assume means, oh, I'll jack off tomorrow. I guess. So hell no, I'm not. I wouldn't change a thing.
Good stuff. Eric.
My non-answer will be about a personal story of... when I was during my salad days, trying my best to keep the lights on and the bills paid, and I had just enough recognition that I was getting bigger assignments, and my agent called and said, "This is an amazing gig. It's a rewrite, and it's to a property that the studio is absolutely going to make. They did not make it, and we want to send it to you." And I read it, and it was a draft by Josh Zedumer. And it was fucking amazing. The script was just stellar. And I said, hell yeah, get me this meeting. And I went in, and it was somebody at Paramount. And long ago, they're not there now, so I don't get in trouble. And I said, listen, you need to make this script. Do not hire anybody. Fine, if it's a problem with the director, you get yourself a new director. But this is the script you should make. And they're like, oh, is that why you came all the way over? Yeah, that's right. Do not, like, you can get another writer to make something different. You won't get someone to make it better. Josh cracked this. And if my voice helps you, like, tell somebody upstairs that this is it, then great. I walked out, I'm like, I feel so much better. My agent called and said, what the hell did you just do? How can you get fired from something you didn't even get? That's what happened. And I would absolutely do that for Taylor Sheridan. Hell or High Water, I would say, get me that. Holy shit, this script was amazing. And
And don't change a thing. All right, Mike.
Yeah. I mean, I feel that writing is such a fragile, difficult thing, and these are all my brothers and sisters, and I would just encourage them to go be themselves
good
more.
Good stuff.
That is such a Mike Mills answer.
Well, that was the 10th time I've asked that question, and I loved each of your answers. Your work, your writing specifically, has inspired the world. Give it up again for the 10th annual Oscar Screenwriting Nominees.
Thank you, guys.
And that's how the Q&A went down. Special thanks again to this podcast sponsor, screencraft.org. I hope you'll visit their site. And of course, use your discount coupon code QAPODCAST, all one word, to save 10% off of any screenplay competition entry fee on screencraft.org. And of course, also special thanks to all of the Oscar nominees who showed up for this year's 10th annual Screenwriting Nominees Q&A. It really meant a lot to me that each and every one of them came down, and it was just a blast and an honor to interview them. This episode in the Q&A with Jeff Goldsmith is a copyright of Unlikely Films Incorporated in 2017. All rights reserved. And folks, I just want to thank you again for spreading the word about issue 25 of Backstory and our upcoming Oscar issue on the iPad, and also letting your friends and family know that Backstory.net will become the fully functional magazine this year, 2017. I've seen the tests. And hey, if you'd like to show your support and donate to this free podcast so it can continue to buy new equipment and use these funds to pay for my podcast hosting fees, feel free to send a PayPal virtual tip to yogoldsmith@gmail.com. Any amount is greatly appreciated. As for your social networking needs, you could follow Yo Goldsmith on Twitter or could check out my Facebook fan page. I'm Jeff Goldsmith, the publisher of Backstory and the host of the Q&A, thanking you for tuning in and telling you to stay out of trouble. Till next week.